for another lovely time around the table.
Big fat. It's time to that was great. And Justin, you did it again.
Justin, yay.
Yeah, go ahead.
This evening's topic, why socialism can't ever work. I've heard the idea spoken by politicians, some statement, that socialism doesn't work, and I've always wanted to ask aloud, but didn't, why doesn't it work? So I went to dig a little bit deeper and examine the claim of socialism, and I came up to the conclusion of my own that socialism can't ever work. Now that's pretty adamant, pretty dogmatic. There's some things in life that are dogmatic, and you can't escape it, like death. Okay, I agree that there are some things in this universe that are quite dogmatic. You can't spin it, you can't rationalize it away, it's just pretty important. It's there. And it's a reality. So, they say death and taxes in it, right? Hopefully we're going to do something about the taxes. I don't know about death. We can do something about taxation. I'm not sure we can do anything about death. But there are, we come to the idea that there are some things that are pretty adamant and pretty serious. Things that are confrontational, personally, as well as in life itself, and all of life itself. And when we look at the idea of socialism, we're not really speaking about a system. I submit to you that we're speaking about the true nature of man. What works with man? And to say that some socialism works with some people and doesn't with others is simply to say some people love misery and choose misery. Alright? And that there is a difference between humanity. That so I want to suggest to you that there is, to begin with, a humanity, a level of humanity that is common, and it does not have to do with location, geography, or race, or nationality. It has to do with our being as human beings. And so I want to begin with the presuppositions of how we're going to look at socialism. How we look at socialism today in 2008, and we might have defined it differently in 1987, 1990, right in there, after the Soviet Union dissolved. So it has evolved as to what we mean when we think of socialism. So let's look at the premises, the promise of socialism. It has a purpose. It has a goal, an end in sight. It has a purpose, a promise. It has a premise. It's based on certain ideas, that it's premise about human nature. And it has certain policies or methods or means to achieve the promise that it offers to us. So see if this does not suit your understanding and your study of socialism. It's the work of socialism, the job or the intent of socialism, is to the promise is to close the gap, the material or economic gap, between what we see as the rich and the poor. There's a disparity between the haves and those that have not, so far as this material life is concerned. And again, it has an altruistic intent, which is to help people. To help people rise and improve their living, their life. This is in hoping for some kind of an end to what they call material inequality. Material inequality. Milton Friedman says that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, which was the final blow to the belief in socialism, and we'll look at the kind of socialism which the Soviet Union had purported had advanced in the traditional sense of government ownership and operation of the means of production as either feasible or desirable. That state ownership of and elimination of all private property was really impractical. And of course that was seen as a possible alternative to capitalism or to free market. And the Soviet Union's collapse unveiled the truth of the matter. And so today, when we think about socialism, and when we think about the relationship to where we are in our nation today, it is not so much state ownership of and control of all property, although you would wonder about that since the last few hours. But they profess socialism today is meaning a welfare state, right? A welfare state. Providing assistance to those that have not. So it's a welfare state. It's to benefit the poor, so to speak. The premise of this is that socialism says that mankind has somehow a predisposition to be selfish and to be unjust to one another. We need to reconstruct humanity by external forces. We've got to remake the behavior, change the behavior of mankind so that he will contribute, that he is disposed to give and to store, sort of a store, a universal store of all that is good, all the goods, and then let it be redistributed. Now, what they're dealing with is a humanity that is, again, resistant. So in order to overcome this resistance, we have to fight certain forces, certain laws, and certain threats, if you will. And what is the goal here in reshaping this nature of man? Is to get him to subordinate to collective group thinking. And I think we can see the kind of that actually happening through a type of education. We call it socialization. But where his needs, whether it's dietary, educational, healthcare, housing, wages, all these, are decided collectively. All your needs are decided collectively. Submit and subordinate these decisions to the group. And they're decided, again, by the collective. And cause him to be able to support, not only subordinate, but depend upon society, the group, for his well-being. And so that he will, in a sense, cooperate to establish what we call the common good. A sort of become a group-centered worker bee, to work for, all right, society as a whole, the collective. Do your part, so to speak, in it. And basically, if the premise is that we need to produce a new being, a new environment that will shape and form the kind of humanity that will sacrifice his own interests for the interests of everyone, right, the whole. And that's the work of socialism, to form and shape by external conditions a humanity that will be unselfish, and a humanity that will contribute and give to the common good. What are the policies that it uses to form and shape and produce this society, this helping of others? And we find historically that has been taxation and tyrannical tactics. Right? Taxation and tyrannical tactics. Congress, through the tax code, we read, is to confiscate the earnings of one American to give to another American in the forms of what? Prescription drugs, Social Security, food stamps, farm subsidies, or bailouts, all kinds of bailouts. It forcibly uses one person to serve the purposes of another. And I think the operative word is it's force. The thing about all socialism, it could be subtle, it could be very explicit, but it's force. And this is the objection that socialism has in every instance. Because it's the fact that and the human being is forced, all right, into this cooperation, into, again, bringing this, bringing the promise or the work of socialism to pass. Now, Walter Williams, the economist from George Mason University, further said, this is the problem with socialism, where one person is forced to take care of another. It's a the operating word is force. Force of law or threat of penalty is a form of force. There is no moral argument that justifies using the coercive powers of government to force one person to bear the expense of taking care of another. But that's the kind of individual that is shaped by the forces of socialism, the policies of socialism. And so ultimately, the objection we want to give here about socialism is that it denies both the rich and poor, not just the rich, so to speak, but it denies both their unalienable rights of their own life, their own liberty, and their own pursuit of happiness, which our Constitution does indeed protect. Now, what do we mean by right? The enabled rights of life. I want you to understand that the right to life is really a right to a separate and distinct existence, both rich and poor, without anyone being classified according to a group. Not all rich are greedy, and not all poor, all right, are lazy. True? Mm-hmm. But what they've done is classified us in our groups, whether rich or poor or middle, but we are denied our own separate existence, whether rich or poor. And that is a violation of our true human nature. Not only that, but we're dealing with the idea of natural liberty. It goes against what we call natural liberty, in which no belief, no opinion, nor the will of another person is imposed by force or coercion. And when you look at socialism, it operates by coercion. And so by the actions of socialism, it violates something very fundamental to being a human being, to our own makeup, universally. And then what's the pursuit of happiness? Some of us may be a little fuzzy on what that might mean, but I want to address it according to what the Founding Fathers understood the pursuit of happiness was. And this is related to your own livelihood, to pursue your own way of making a living, to your own individual enterprise, your own enjoyment of the product of your own hands. That's the pursuit of your own happiness, your own livelihood, and to enjoy the productivity of your own hands, and not for another person to enjoy that or take that from you. And all of this is protected in the Constitution of the United States of America as never before in the history of mankind. It deals again, what's the nature of man, and how is man to operate according to what ideas? And we want to look at ultimately what how we operate within this Constitution. I want to go here again and look at the wisdom of the Constitution of the United States. This is still our infrastructure. This is the infrastructure of our nation. And this is our protection of our life, liberty, and property. That's the intent of this document. And I want to look at the idea that there has been unconstitutional taxation, unconstitutional use of a person's earnings. And you can go back and verify that in our Constitution as a nation. And this is not about a party. This is not about conservatism or liberalism. Is it about America? And both sides have violated this idea of and practice unconstitutional use of a person's earnings. Now, there is legitimate or legal justification for taxes to only finance federal activities pertaining to the nation, They are legitimate. What are these? They're outlined in Article 1, Section 8. They're right there. And anything beyond this is unconstitutional. And it says that it lists what the federal functions of Congress are. And what is to be financed? What is their spending authority? National defense, post offices, post roads, courts, and a few other activities. James Madison says, the father of our Constitution, in Federalist Paper number 45, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. They are defined. They're laid out. And they're not to go beyond what has been limited. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. They're infinite, and it's a possibility in the local states. But what is for the national expense account is very defined, very defined. The former will be, that is the national, that will be exercised principally on what external objects, as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce, with which last power of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. And again, the taxes that are legitimate are those that pertain to those things that are listed right here. And the intent was not to grow the finances of government, to limit it. We are getting into trouble because of over expenditure, both in California, $28 billion, and rising. And the national, which is, no one can even tell, is $10, $12 trillion already, and that's within a week's time, or more, month's time. Infinite, but it's none of those. The expenditures, most of those are illegal constitutionally. The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution are few and defined as well, from such repetition. Congress, therefore, has no authority for the Constitution's general welfare clause. Now, most of our taxes today are excused by something called the general welfare that Congress used today. And furthermore, what Madison says, that with respect to the two words, general welfare, and by the way, when you want to know how to rightly explain the Constitution, go to the father of the Constitution, James Madison. He was there. Get original resource. He took the notes. He took the records of all the debates. They're there. And what they decided, what this phrase would mean, and this is not an umbrella for anything you would like for good, is he said it was qualified by the detail of whatever powers are given to Congress, those are the ones financed. Anything beyond is unconstitutional. Even Thomas Jefferson, who was not there, understood. Congress has not unlimited powers to provide for the general welfare. Only those specifically enumerated. Specifically. Now, if we want more, they need to amend it and add more, but nothing's been amended since 1787 concerning expenses. And so we can add, but we have not added. We have simply spent and assumed. The detailed powers referred to was actually laid out in the Constitution. Otherwise, we are playing loose with the law. And again, similar to if you can do it in one instance, why can't you do it in another instance? And it goes on and on and on. Same thing with the bailout. If you can bail out one company, why can't you bail out another company? You can bail out this individual. There is no limitation. If you do not reason from the principles and the ideas here, we haven't been taught to do this. I think, again, our ignorance is innocent. But nevertheless, it's costly. Ignorance is costly, whether it's innocent or deliberate. And we have to look at this because we are about to face the music. All right? We're going to pay the price for ignorance. And so consider these things. An article written, Ideas on Liberty. Each person is free under our Constitution in its original form is to determine your own needs. Your needs do not have to be decided by a group. How much you need here and how much you do. It's personal, it's private, it's pertaining to you. But in socialism, it's decided by a group what your income ought to be, what you really need to have. All right? It is denying your separate existence. denying you your separate and distinct existence. And in this system, and what they're allowing is that you decide your own needs, and through labor, your own labor, and free market voluntary exchanges, you produce what you require to satisfy your own needs. This is reasonable. This is how we were made to live. How do we know this? There's a manual for how to live. We'll discuss that later. But there's an operating manual, all right? Because the manufacturer sent us down, up or down, with directions. How to put it together, all right? How where the parts go, and how they function, and how it sustains itself, and how to live and walk, and how to get gain, and how not to be poor. You want to know where it is? No, government activity is restricted, and this is the purpose of law. The purpose of our Constitution is protect the individual's rights against what? To punish fraud, punish theft, and any physical force upon you. That's the function of government, is to punish selfishness. Let the government punish the actions that are selfish, not reward them. And that's the purpose, the right purpose of law and order. Now, next, it is unconstitutional. It's an unconstitutional act of Congress, says Walter Ames, for Congress to the tax code to, and it's actually confiscation. They just simply reach in, right? The earnings of one American to give to another American in the forms of prescription drugs, Social Security, food stamps, etc. We mentioned this before. Again, it's all about force. All about force. And it how it, again, intends to achieve and to help people. I mean, the whole point is to help people. We want to help people. What's the right way to help? Some help I don't want. They used to give me a lot of assistance to help me, and the more assistance they gave me, the worse help, the worse, more work I had to do. You ever got there? Those of you who are working at a job, they give you helpers, and they make more work for you because it's the wrong kind of help. And there's a help, and there's no help. And things that, again, imply use force and tyranny is of no use to rich or poor. Socialism uses coercion to achieve what is seen as good ends. All right. You know, the idea of health is that it must be, because really health is voluntary. It's voluntary and not forced. Don't you understand that when you force health, it builds resentments between the individuals? Watch your siblings. Go help your brother. Why do I have to help him? Right? He can do it for himself. You see, I never had anybody help for me. Why should I help him? It's just that kindergarten level. Okay? If I can do it, he can do it. That kind of argument. It just builds resentment. If it's forced, if it's not from a place of real love or charity. And taxation is in the place of charity. How do we resolve this? Well, Thomas Sowell says this: those who claim to represent the helpless and the poor endeavor to run the marketplace, the economy, so things are fair, so to speak. And what they do is they take over capital, private property, and make all things public, take it away from property owners, those who own these things, and public. Make it all public domain, so to speak, public ownership. Now, Sewell says you can run the economy either by the state or private enterprise, and there's no two ways about it. Let's look at what has actually happened. I want to propose to you that the free market enterprise that we have in this country alone has helped the poor. Okay? If we do a study, you look into this, that the free instead of state-operated market, but a free market enterprise system alone has helped the poor. The study is this, that poverty in the United States, in an absolute sense, has virtually disappeared. Today, there's nothing remotely resembling poverty of yesteryear. However, if poverty is defined in the relative sense, and it is, I mean, the poor in America are rich elsewhere, are they not? In some realm. So how they have defined poverty is those in the 5%, right? The lower 5% income realm. But the lower 5% in our country would be quite wealthy in some other countries. But it's defined as the 5% lower rung of income producers or earners. Therefore, if that's the case, poverty will always be with us no matter how poverty is defined. And that's a great observation. The recent Census Bureau report substantially exaggerates the extent of poverty and economic inequality in the United States. Policies that require welfare recipients to work or prepare for work as a condition of receiving aid, and that encourage the formation of healthy marriages, are the best vehicles for further reducing poverty. So what they've narrowed it down to is that poverty in our country is not because of some the existing exploitation or greed of the rich, but basically it's because of those not working and those that have, again, broken families, where the marriages are not holding together households. And this is what they've found out from studies. So how has poverty been long-term? Because it's the result of personal behavior, personal decision. Not because of a lack of jobs, it's because there is the decision not to work or, again, to maintain the house, the household. Two main reasons that American children are poor, and the poorest in society will be the children, are they not?
Mm-hmm.
They're the most innocent and the most, of course, sufferers of poverty. Their parents don't work much and fathers are absent from the home. In good economic times or bad, the typical poor family with children is supported by only 800 hours of work each year. That amounts to 16 hours of work per week. Father absence is another major cause of child poverty. Now, what we've been taught is what? Exploitation, or greed, or some kind of victim, all right? Corporation. But when you look at close and personal here, this is really the bottom floor of it. Nearly two-thirds of poor children reside in single-parent homes. Each year, an additional 1.3 million children are born out of wedlock. If work in each family were raised to 2,000 hours per week, the equivalent of one adult working 40 hours per week throughout the year, nearly 75% of poor children would be lifted out of official poverty. If welfare could be turned around to really require work and to encourage marriage, remaining poverty would drop quickly. Now, that's what the finding is concerning poverty, enduring poverty in this country. Now, what we're seeing in the last decades, the rich are getting richer, but what, the poor are also getting richer. Poverty is not static for people willing, what, to work. And by the way, according to the manual, the operating manual for man, work is the means of wealth. Productivity and industry is the means of a livelihood and pursuit of happiness. A University of Michigan study shows that only 5% of those in the bottom fifth of the income distribution in 1975 remained there in 1991. What happened to them? They moved up to the top three-fifths of the income distribution, middle class or higher. Moreover, 3 out of 10 of the lowest income earners in 1975 moved all the way into the top fifth of income earners by 1991. Those who were poor in 1975 had an inflation-adjusted average income gain of $27,745 by 1991. Those workers who were in the top fifth of income earners in 1975 were better off in 1991 by an average of only $4,354. So, not only has income increased over because of our free market enterprise system that is in this country, but also material benefits, that is, who has air conditioning, who has a dishwasher, who has television, big screen, who has all of those, again, benefits. It says there that material benefits in the past only by the super rich, in the past owned only by the super rich, are in today's capitalist society enjoyed by nearly everyone. This undeniable fact demolishes accusations that capitalism creates inequality, and that's a recent study. So they felt it's fallacious to say that the system that we purport produces the poor, it helps the poor, in fact. So let's look at the failures of socialism, historical failures of socialism. And I'm just looking at basically a few examples in recent history. Thomas Sowell says, in all very different societies around the world, the story of socialism has been a story of high hopes and bitter disappointments. Attempts to redistribute wealth repeatedly led to the redistribution of what? Poverty. Now, this is a short history of socialism. History begins, he says, 2 centuries ago, after the French Revolution, and it ends with Tony Blair. Interesting. That we can study socialism between the French Revolution and the leaving of Tony Blair, who brought the Labour Party back to power by dropping the core of its socialist agenda and putting distance between himself and previous Labour Party governments. That's interesting. Whose social policies had so backfired that the party lost 4 consecutive national elections. Now, that's in England, okay? So, officially, this idea of government-operated economy, state ownership of the economy, or running it, is actually was a dismal disappointment. Alex de Tocqueville, again, he wrote this, he's between 1805 and 1859, about the time when socialism began in Europe. He's a French historian. He visited America, made these observations. Again, people closest to the times will tell you that democracy and socialism have nothing in common but one word, equality. But notice the difference. While democracy seeks equality and liberty, socialism seeks equality and restraint and servitude. Right? A common servitude, a common serving of service to the state, all forced. Now, we have a case in the Israelite kibbutz, or I'm not familiar, that's called voluntary socialism. Let's look at this case in history. And this is the experience. The Israeli kibbutz was one of those common, prominent, and benign, benevolent forms of voluntary collectivism in the 20th century. Benign because, unlike socialist prison states, they existed in a mostly free nation, and the members were free to leave. However, even voluntary forms of collectivism have faced universal disaster. This is a case in point. 2/3 of these kibbutzes have voted to privatize, as the Christian Science Monitor writes, and more are continuing to do so. The remaining ones persist mainly because of massive government subsidies. They're not doing very well. Okay. Now, that's voluntary socialism. 70 years of cradle to grave care in Sweden. People used to hold up Sweden as, ha-ha, it's working. Well, let's look how it works. This is where, again, the state plans what your needs are. The state plans what your needs are, and the state will provide those needs through what? Storehousing and redistribution. Well, watch this. At a very early stage, these state planners were concerned about what happens when too many people are on the dole. I'll tell you what they did in China. Limit the population, mm-hmm. because they can't feed them all. They still are. I think China's 5% population, what's it, 5%? No, right. 5 billion people. They're about 5% of the population of the world. How much, what is that? We'll come back on that one. Years ago, it was revealed that tens of thousands of Swedes with government-determined undesirable traits. Now they're going to decide, all right, who's going to participate. They have to ration, because there's not enough. When you don't have enough, then you start rationing, all right, your needs. And so those with poor IQs or low IQs, okay, or gypsy features, I don't know what those are, do you know what those are? Were involuntarily sterilized beginning in the 1930s.
This is Sweden.
Indeed, that, by the way, in some countries, if you reach a certain age, you just drag, okay? I think some of us in our golden years are going to be very suspicious of you young people, okay? Right. Because we're going to be a drag on society, and we're just in a way, okay? Indeed, that particular collectivist benefit remained on the books well into the 70s. Another innovative program involved giving large amounts of sweets to the mentally retarded order to study truth decay. And so, make them useful. Okay? Everybody has a use. For 7 decades, Sweden has managed to endure government redistribution of wealth. How? Perhaps it's a small population. Sweden has fewer people than Illinois does. That's why it's lasted this long. Maybe it's the homogeneity of the society. All right, you know what they are. Possibly it's because Sweden sits out war. That's, you know, when you don't have a defense program, you have plenty of money to spare, okay? That's what's going to cut back. We're going to have to cut back somewhere. It's probably going to be in our defense. Saving huge amounts of money. They can just simply rely on America to protect them, right? Whatever the reason, most Swedes are apparently satisfied to set aside their independence and pay huge taxes in exchange for some perceived economic security. You know, the tax bracket, 50%, there are certain amounts that the government takes 50% of their income. Mm-hmm. The report went on to note that if Sweden were a U.S. state, it would be without doubt but be the poorest one. The median American household income in the late 1990s was more than $39,000. In Sweden, it was the equivalent of under $27,000. The study's authors noted that if the present trend continues, things that are commonplace in the United States will be regarded as the most luxury in Sweden. Sporadically, Sweden has made small steps away from... Now, we heard in 2002, somewhere in there, that Sweden began to reverse policy. You've heard that. And absolutely. They began to reduce taxes. And by the way, how do you undo socialism? Begin reducing taxes. Remember that. Okay? How to reduce socialism. That is, give back, let the people keep more of their own productivity, their own earnings, and they will produce. They will be more productive, and the state will benefit. In fact, revenue for a nation always increases when you lower taxes. In fact, we double the government revenue when Reagan lowered the taxes after Carter. Doubled it. The government will receive more, not less, if it did not tax. Can you imagine? It doesn't make sense, but it is because the revenue comes from the productivity of the people, not from taxing them. So lifting some regulatory burdens to help enterprises start up there, to help business, and whittling down the national debt temporarily. And so, but now the Swedes have to learn to live without government care. That's a hard one, isn't it? When you've been conditioned, made subordinate. Now they have something else to deal with to keep it coming down. In Toronto, that's Canada, right? I'm begging to differ in Toronto. Notice the observation here of this writer from Australia. In Canada... Forgive me. If Canada is supposed to be this socialist utopia where everyone is taken care of, not all, forgive me for that one, okay? Why is it that I think that Toronto has more beggars per square kilometer than probably just about any city in the Western world? I probably know at least 100 times more per square meter than even in New York. Why? Socialism doesn't work. Canadians get free health care, but clearly high taxes kill incentives to work, which is against human nature. And Toronto's unemployment rate is roughly 6.5. I think we're there ourselves. But not really very low if you compare with, again, Australia, etc. I'm not sure how the social security system works in Canada, but given the number of people begging, I guess that it doesn't work very well. High taxes obviously aren't providing an adequate social security net, while at the same time they stifle enterprise. And that's the experience in Toronto, Canada. How many people boast of the health care? They have great health care, but they have great beggars too. They become beggars for their health care. Go figure. How about this fiasco in Hawaii just this year? Did you hear about Hawaii?
Yeah.
Dropping the only state universal child health care program in the country. And what happened there? It went bankrupt. What happened? They will stop giving health care to the 2,000 children. Why? Because families were dropping private coverage so their children would be eligible for the subsidized plan. Okay? Unintended consequences.
doing all right.
You think you're helping the poor, but everybody's like, well, I'll be poor too. And join in, get in. And it, after 7 months, the whole thing bankrupt in Hawaii. Think now. People who were already able to afford health care began to stop paying for it so they could get it for free. Why not? Right? Look out for yourself. All right, this is yourself.
I don't believe that was the intensive program.
Yeah. And look what happens. Look what we did to American black families. The assumption that spending more of the taxpayers' money will make things better has survived all kinds of evidences that it has made things worse. The black family, which survived slavery, discrimination, poverty, wars, and depressions, began to come apart as the federal government moved in with its well-financed programs to help, right? When you could finance and support, put on welfare families that were fatherless and only encouraged families to be fatherless. Does that make sense to you? Thomas Sowell, some of you may not know, is a wonderful economist, and he happens to be a wonderful scholar. And he himself is a black man. So I trust his observations. So the question we have tonight is, why do you keep trying over and over again and expecting a result other than failure? Why do we keep trying socialism over and over again, expecting it not to fail? Right. Some people call that, what, insanity?
Mm-hmm.
So the observers have made this point. When confronted with the universal failure of socialism, what do socialists do? They do one of three things. Pretend the evidence doesn't exist. Okay. Then they just claim that socialist governments are not really true Marxism and Leninism. Or they change their philosophy to reject material success. We don't really need as much as we think we do. Let's just minimize. That's environmentalism. Okay? They change their philosophy, what we're after. And then, of course, with the failure of the Soviet Union, they point to voluntary communes, examples of successful collectivism instead. And so, but again, why the dance? Why the shifting? They began to see that every failure is not because the system is bad, it's because of bad leaders. And so all we need to do is find the right leader, okay? That's the magic, all right, button, sort of cure. Get the right leader. And what do we find in history, though? Among people of every race, color, and creed all around the world, socialism has led to hunger in countries that used to have surplus food to export. Its economic disasters have afflicted virtually every industry. In the communist version, it killed far more innocent civilians in peacetime than Hitler killed in the death camps during World War II. The concentration of political power necessary to try to reduce economic inequalities has allowed tyrants like Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot to impose their notions of caprice on millions of others, draining them economically or slaughtering them en masse or exploiting them sexually. So, again, it's a matter of leadership. You get the right leader planning and overseeing this society, then it will work. And that's what they're always pursuing, the right leader. They're looking for that right leader. But human nature is really the problem. Right? And they're trying to change that. I forget about socialism, right?
When they see that change human nature, let me know.
That he's at this point in time not evolved to the point he can live in a collective society. Okay, he has to be brought along, and he doesn't have the ability to live content, happy, or happy peasants, you know, kind of idea, in state collectivism. He can't be a peasant and be happy. All right, we've got to change that. Also, he says, as far as the kibbutz founder of Gosh says, I've reached the conclusion that humans are egotists and like to keep things for themselves rather than for the general public. The idea that everyone will eat from the same plate doesn't exist anymore. Okay, and so we just have to create that being that doesn't mind eating from the same plate. Thomas Sowell says this, nowhere have people been willing to work as well for the common good as they do for their own benefit. Now, there's a truth to that. Mm-hmm. And it is not selfishness. It's simply the way we're constructed. Mm-hmm. It's the way human beings are, all right, without exception. We are all created the same.
That's right.
All right, so says. the manual. Now, socialism is still an attractive idea. It's still, and in fact, it's very seductive because it really appeals to human vanity. The fact that we can, through science, all right, through create and change basic human nature, we can change you, all right, somehow, and we can by they call it stick and carrot, okay, carrot and stick. We can reward indolence and punish industry. How's that? And get that going for us. Bring you to a point where all the necessity that you need society, that you require society, okay? That, well, we have that time. I don't have any friends. I need, right, to be with people. I'm a social being. That comes all the way through, okay? And so I'll create that in you, and then you will fit right in. And free the people of the necessity of making a living. Then you've got them, you see. That they don't have to make their own living. Make their own way. That's seductive, isn't it?
That would be nice.
Yeah. You have to worry, all right, about next month's bills. Now, I like this statement. I don't know how you like it, but you don't have to like it. Socialism is the religion people get when they lose their religion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I heard an individual say this. You know, most people don't believe in God, so they believe in government.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, isn't it?
True.
Mm-hmm. Most people don't believe in government, so they have to believe in God, so they have to believe in government. So what has happened because of that? The state has therefore become all powerful and supreme.
And supreme.
So, two conclusions I want to make for you to consider now. In denying the individual what I call unalienable rights, you know what unalienable rights is? You can't separate it from your being. You cannot. You can, there's no operation you can make. There's no medicine. There is nothing you can take to separate this understanding that you have your own life and that you have your own liberty, and that you have your own lively means of livelihood, pursuit of happiness. This historical practical failure of socialism only affirms this irrefutable unalienability of these rights. It only confirms it or affirms it. It doesn't prove that it doesn't exist. To deny the presupposition that men have a claim to unalienable rights is to deny the absolute law of nature. That is the law of self-preservation and self-interest regarding the private advantage and personal interest of oneself. You are made to live, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And the first law of living is preserve it. Do all you can to preserve your life. Self-preservation is the first law of life and living. And the universal fundamental law of man is the law of nature. Now, where did that come from? The law of nature, John Locke says, is the will of the maker. It's the will of the Creator. It's the will of God, the author of life. And he cannot be denied. And this law, if you deny it, has destructive consequences, as we have seen time and time again under socialism. One, you don't have to believe in God to believe in the law of gravity, do you?
No.
You should simply one simply needs to be afraid to attempt to defy it. That's all. Okay? No amount of unbelief can undo what is divinely established. And this is what socialism proves over and over again, that man's nature doesn't fit with socialism. It doesn't. It's not a fit. It's not suitable to his makeup. He doesn't prosper. He is unhappy. He is, again, it goes against his unalienable rights and his nature. What I purport, we've said earlier in the last few weeks that America offers to mankind an alternative to socialism by its structure. America's political structure through the Constitution, and it's a representative republic, not a democracy. That is, it is a republic of local self-governing states. And this structure rests upon the right application of what we call self-evident truth. It's self-evident to every human being. And this structure not only grants, but it facilitates the proper and efficient way of helping the poor. We are interested in helping our fellow man, but there's a proper way to do it. And there is a political structure that allows that to happen efficiently, without waste, without overexpenditure, and where the funds really get down to where it needs to be. Do you understand? And that is very simply in the local sphere. The powers not delegated, says the Constitution, which is the care of the poor, not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, this is the 10th Amendment, nor prohibited by it to the states, we reserve to the states, respectively, or to the people. The people will take care of its own sphere. And I present to you an excerpt from Richard Frothingham's The Rise of the Republic, written in 1890, before Marxist history tainted our history. And what I have here is a representation of the northern and the middle and the southern states. New England states, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. And notice how they were set up. Invariably, they had their own manner of government or administration, but they invariably had two things in common. They taxed themselves, and they took care of their own poor. It was locally taken care of. These things, as we've been discussing before, marriage, voting, those things are reserved to the states. And it was efficient. And it was voluntary. But it was local. It's the local sphere where things really get taken care of. And as things nationally begin to erode, we're going to have to resort to coming back to the local sphere and strengthening that and shoring up what's inside within our sphere. And the dependency is within, not without. Within our own. California is taking care of what is germane to California. That's how we are set up politically and structured to do just that, and maintaining our independence from the national storehouse, so to speak. And so, the alternative, the answer to socialism is self-government of the local sphere. This is no, again, we're talking about how man's nature and what cooperates with man's nature, what suits him, what fits him, is the structure that has been established in this country with local self-government, and the people taking care of their own business, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare. If it's local, it is efficient and it is effective. And socialism claims, again, this national control, which is, again, the opposite, and inefficient, and, of course, no help whatsoever, and not personal, but forced, and not charitable, but absolutely servitude to both poor and rich. So, any questions? Does this ring true to you?
How do you see it different from communism?
Pardon?
How do you see socialism different from communism?
Socialism claims to be a step toward communism, which is again it's self-operating. It's sort of but they're practically the same today. The Chinese call themselves communists, but they practice really socialism. It's a means to an end. Socialism means to communism, which is a society that operates without force. You know, it's communal. It's communal. Socialism uses law to bring it about, right? Uses coercion to bring it about, and hoping that law will fall away, that force will fall away as humanity is, opposition to it is eliminated. That's what it is.
So communism is supposed to be the end result, which is supposed to be
Socialism is using the state to bring communism, and then once communism is in place, the state will go away.
Right. But we can never get there because we've always stopped at socialism.
That's right. Okay. Because it stopped, doesn't work. It goes against the true nature of what man is and how he needs to maintain his life.
As a representative of the public, then American socialism, isn't it voluntary socialism?
Ours is voluntary
yes,
socialism.
Yes, because we're responsible for we're inviting.
Right, right. We've we're lost. Yeah, and there's a reason for that. Again, that's why if we can minimize the corruption if we maintain the local.
Yeah.
Strengthen local. We can't generalize. We can't collectivize. We can localize. Okay. To dismantle socialism is to again strengthen the local and localize. And increase the self-government of the local state and county and town. Bring it home. Bring government home. Okay. Manage more and manage well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. You don't really hear people talk about America being a representative republic anymore.
Right.
You don't really hear people describe it as a democratic
democracy.
Yeah, so could you just explain how that change came about and sort of what it means?
Right. The idea of well,
another lecture.
Well, I can go back to a former lecture, but I got the term "representative republic" by the founding fathers when they described this nation as a representative republic because it was a representation of states, not of the general people. Not the popular mass of people representing the states. And therefore, this, the states reserving to themselves the majority of the government of themselves. And democracy began to slip and into that this in the 1830s, and it began to lose that concept, and where popular rule became more important than representative rule. And that's where the primaries come in, party system comes in, and it oversweeps. And it's an imitation of what we began to see happen in Europe in the French Revolution. So that's an influence. But it was a matter of an education that came into our nation about that time, and a democratic education. Education for the common man rather than the individual. The vocabulary began to switch and change. And so the decline naturally came into this idea of collective group determination of the will. Right. We began to be ruled by majority rather than by the principles. And so simply because the majority wants it doesn't make it constitutional. Okay?
Make it right either.
Yeah, the history shows that the majority is generally right.
And it's always, but that's why we have to reason from the principles of our nation, not from the majority and the people's will. It's not about the people's will. You know, the people can change their will by amending the Constitution, but we're not a government of the people, actually, mm-hmm. but of the Constitution. Yes.
Quick question. We were talking, Chairman, about the. In the Constitution where it talks about the powers of the president, and I didn't actually didn't see anything about the, what was it, you were talking about the veto.
He has veto
power. Oh, it does have veto power.
So he does. It must. Yes,
it must
I wish they used them.
Yeah, right.
Right. And when there is a, when the presidency and the Congress and the courts are not independent of each other, you really have one party. You really have a dictatorship.
Okay. You just said a moment ago that it's not a government of the people. I thought it was a government of the people before the Republic.
That's Abraham Lincoln.
That's true. It came from, the Constitution came from the people, though. And it doesn't go, it doesn't change as the people change. It's a fixed document. And if it's, the people change it, if they want it changed. All right. But it is a rule of
the majority. Is what
yeah, majority about. Of the people. It's not by democracy.
It's not supposed to be Washington and the people. It's supposed to be the 50 states and Washington, but independent. Do you understand?
I understand. It's not. Again,
at the local level, you have to come back to the local level.
Would you say then that the states are a democratic republic, each individual?
Well, yeah, the democratic aspect is the idea of that there are voters and electors, the majority of the voters determine the law. That's always the case. Whoever votes, the majority of the voters declare. When you make voting. When you increase the numbers who vote, you really democratize the vote more and more, and perhaps deal with a lot of emotional rather than principled decision making. Again, it's mob rule. Democracy has always been described as mob rule rather than reasonable, educated, illiterate rule.
But it's not likely that America is going to go back.
To represent a republic?
From democracy. I mean,
oh, it can very easily if we haven't been educated in the Constitution to understand that.
Yeah.
But once we know how to operate this, and once we're threatened by again losing our liberties, we will come back to it. We will have to. Otherwise, we will be. Will they eliminate all the distinctions between the states? And they'll divide this country into regions, right? They'll just remap this whole thing, and we'll lose the individuality of our republic. And it's only because of ignorance that it can be done. But there are already plans in the making where they are dividing this nation to regions and ignoring state ability, that thing that belongs to the state. And it's only simply if we don't exercise it, it will be lost. It's a matter of exercising it. If we begin to exercise it locally, it will come forth and hold because it's there. It's there unless we let it go. And so the consequences, again, are very destructive to our economy. They're destructive to our independence, our own ability to manage our own affairs. That's what we're dealing with. So you examine that and see what it is that we can do and understand to do just on a regular basis in your own self-government.
So what's a person to do if they don't want to, if they do try to tax us to pay for all these bailouts and we don't agree with it? What if you don't agree with it? You can't just not pay.
No. Congress decides that. Congress has already approved, apparently. They've given the authority over to the Treasurer to do that. See? So no, we're under law obligation to it, but we can work through representative government. We can work through change the representatives in Congress.
Oh, yes.
Change the assembly, people in the Assembly of California who has been responsible for overspending and not being under budget. Make them accountable to the electors. But it's going to take a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we can change and qualify for local leadership. And change the local laws. That's the only recourse. That's how we became a nation, and that's how we can maintain the nation. Some people have said that we need a generation like Washington. No, we need a generation better than Washington. George Washington. To maintain this. And I don't think it's impossible. I really don't think it's possible. It's just a matter of knowledge. We Americans, when we find out what we're, when we get, when we get thinking and going, we do. All right, we're doers. Okay, we just lost our way over the last 50 years or so. So, think about these things, will you?
Yes, thank you.